The Barbie movie has delighted some viewers and grated on others. On either side, though, assessments largely gloss over the plot and the pacing of the film to focus on whether impressionable viewers are likely to take the right message from the story. But most people bought tickets for a little entertainment, right? Not a lesson in how to embody gender or pursue careers or resist or reinforce the patriarchy. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. It's not that movies and TV shows and books and pop songs can't have a message, but my guest worries we've entered a strange moment in which we care less about the artistic quality of cultural products and much, much more about whether they accurately reflect our specific values. And that can set us up for tiresome criticism and bad art. Adam Kotzko teaches in the Scheimer Great Book School at North Central College. His recent essay for The Atlantic was titled "Moralism is Ruining Cultural Criticism." Adam, welcome to Think.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You were actually raised in a community that had very distinct ideas about how art works on people who are exposed to it, children in particular. Tell us about that.
Yes, I was brought up in a very conservative evangelical Christian home. And my age cohort was kind of a guinea pig for this large-scale experiment in using pop culture to shape young people's worldviews very intentionally. The view was that every cultural, artifact, such as a movie or especially music, had a very discrete message, and that by taking in that song or that movie or that TV show, you were kind of building up your character so that you would be like that message wants you to be. And so therefore, they made alternative music primarily that would shape you in the correct way to be a conservative Christian.
Speaking of alternative music, there was like a little song that I imagine sounded very cool to you as whatever you were, a 6 or 7 year old.
Yes. The song was entitled Input Output. It was actually very advanced and progressive. They were talking about computers. It basically said that everything that you take in with your brain is going to be what comes out, because our brains are computers for processing these kind of worldview messages.
So the assumption was, I guess, that material was either deliberately infused with a religious message or probably harmful to one's character.
Yes, there's definitely a very either-or thinking. There wasn't much that was taken to be neutral or indifferent. Normally, it was assumed that people who had a message that was other than Christian were not just doing their own thing. They were actively trying to fight against Christian messages and break down people's faith.
So I realize you were a kid at the time. I don't know how aware you were of this, but I wonder if the adults in your world held their own media consumption to the same scrutiny they applied to what children might hear or read or watch.
Yeah, I don't know. For my own parents, it seems like their enforcement was kind of spotty. My dad was a great lover of Christian rock music, and it was very, very important to him to think that rock music as a musical form was compatible with Christianity. But he also listened to the real stuff too, and we became familiar with that. One that was especially puzzling was that we were allowed to watch Cheers, even though it's literally only about people sitting around at a bar. But the only secular tape that we had in the car growing up was Whitney Houston. She was the only one who got an exception to an otherwise all-Christian diet when we were driving around.
Well, she did start out singing in a church, so maybe that was the reason for the exception.
Or maybe she's simply that good. She transcends.
Both could be true. So certainly, Adam, art and pop culture can shape the world we see and the ways we behave within it. But of course, it's more complicated than that, especially for emotionally and intellectually mature adults. Like, I have watched all of Breaking Bad, and I have never wanted to get rich by making drugs and kill anybody that got in my way.
Yes, I've had the same experience. Nor did I want to become a crooked lawyer when I watched Better Call Saul. This kind of one-to-one correspondence, it was already very simplistic when talking about kids, but obviously for adults, it's another matter entirely.
So how has this, if you want to call it an evangelical approach to assessing content, started to spread far beyond conservative Christian culture?
Right. I think we do see a lot of commentary on the conservative side that's like in this kind of paranoid style, as though every TV show or movie or song is trying to send a discreet, like, liberal message to indoctrinate people. That, I think, is expected. You know, they're kind of related social circles, political circles, allied movements. What kind of surprises me is how often I see people on the left espousing a very similar approach.
And in your Atlantic essay, you're choosing to focus on the ways this is playing out on the left. Why is that?
You know, that's where I have wound up personally. I feel a greater personal responsibility. And also, frankly, since I share presuppositions with them, I think that I'm more likely to be persuasive than to somebody who does have a radically different view of the world than I do.
So what evidence are you seeing that modern cultural critics believe our exposure to certain kinds of content will broadly inspire copycat beliefs and behaviors?
I think that it's most prevalent on social media. And it's always a little risky to talk about social media trends because somebody asks you for an example and it's like hard to remember or search for this. But it does seem like there was a huge amount of commentary, obviously, on Oppenheimer and on Barbie. And almost like 90% of it did not give me any information about whether I would actually want to see the movie, whether it's good, whether it's entertaining, whether it's meaningful. It was all about these kind of political signals that they're supposedly sending. And I went so far as to write this article originally as a blog post, kind of annoyed at this trend. Before I had even seen Oppenheimer or Barbie, and just to complain, like, why are you focusing so much on this stuff that is not why we go to the movies at all?
Yeah, I mean, as someone who teaches great books, I think of all the extraordinary literature that we have just in the Western canon. And if we were to hold everything up to having a distinct moral message, we would have to set aside a lot of great work.
Right. I'm glad you brought that up. We would have to set aside a lot of great work, including the Bible itself, which often includes very violent messages. It includes kind of ethnocentric messages of the Israelites. Like, there's a lot of negative things from our perspective. And yet there's also like amazing stories that have shaped later stories and that we'd be really impoverished if we didn't have familiarity with those.
So if critics are busy pointing out all the potential moral hazards of certain works, does this mean they're paying less attention to how these things work as art, like the effectiveness of a script or pacing or casting or directing?
I do think so. I think that they're kind of, it's as though people are watching with a checklist to see like which problematic content has been triggered by each scene. And I think that I did wind up going to see Oppenheimer. And I felt as though a lot of those political critiques were simply missing the point or missing the kind of story that the movie was trying to tell at all.
What's interesting is sometimes these days, you know, there's a spate of criticism in advance of a work being published or released in theaters. Like, many people are ready to leap on it just based on what they expect to find.
Definitely. And I think the case of Oppenheimer is especially interesting because it's not clear to me what political consequences there would be if people had the wrong opinion about a guy who's been dead for decades and who did his work like in the 40s. Like, what is the direct political payoff of thinking Oppenheimer is a better person than he was? It just seems weirdly disconnected from our present day and such a weird thing to worry about.
This movie is everywhere, and I think people know what it's about. But for folks who haven't heard, it's about Robert Oppenheimer, who is the man who is credited with inventing the world's first nuclear weapon. What kinds of criticism has the film drawn? Is it that Oppenheimer is made to seem human here rather than something else?
It's very strange. There's some obvious points. Like, I point out that people are worried that it doesn't present the Japanese perspective, that by focusing on this powerful white man, it's kind of, you know, reinscribing this narrative where white people are in charge of the world. You know, there's a lot of that kind of thing going on. And it seems like there's just a general worry that the audience is naively going to love this guy or think that he is like a model to be emulated and forget that he created this deadly weapon. But like the movie is about how he can't cope with the fact that he has created this deadly weapon.
Well, you go through a thought exercise here in response to that criticism. You imagine that the film did include a subplot about a family in Hiroshima soon to have their world destroyed. There might be lots of ways to tell that story and include it in a film like this one, but your sense is that none of them would be entirely satisfactory to all possible audiences.
Right, I introduced that idea to show that the demand is kind of not fulfillable. Like, depending on how we portray this Japanese family, maybe we're othering them, or maybe we're being patronizing towards them, maybe we're painting them as perfect victims and erasing their humanity. Like, you can always imagine what the further complaint would be once they take the step that is demanded. It seems like there's no satisfying this kind of bottomless demand. And that's what I find kind of strange and problematic about this trend.
Going back again to classic works, your piece made me wonder, if we applied modern style criticism, which I suppose is happening as books are being banned in schools, but you take a book like Moby Dick, and there's a lot of content in Moby Dick that is objectionable by modern standards. That doesn't necessarily take away from the brilliance of the novel itself if you consider it in context.
Right. Yeah, I think from both a conservative and a liberal standpoint, like it's glorifying whaling, which we know is a hugely destructive thing, but also it's hugely homoerotic too. I think that the trend towards book banning, including on very simplistic grounds, like I just saw a story that one school district was basically using ChatGPT to see if books included sex scenes. Because if children don't read books with sex scenes, they're never going to want to have sex, apparently.
Which is interesting if you consider, pre-literate cultures around the world somehow managed to figure this out.
Indeed, yeah. And I think it's also interesting that a lot of these bans seem to be assuming that children become gay through being exposed to the idea of homosexuality, or that they become trans by learning about trans, and otherwise they would just, stay the normal children that the parents hope they would be. And I think we all realize that that's not how it works. Some people simply are gay or are trans, regardless of what literature they're exposed to. And I, for my part, I'm straight, and I don't believe that any amount of the, content with gay themes that I've consumed throughout my life has made a dent in that.
Yeah, it's also interesting to me when we talk about book banning, on behalf of children. I mean, these days it's such a struggle to get kids to read. It doesn't seem helpful to take away things that might be interesting to children, because their themes are not appropriate. Like, do we want them reading, or do we want them reading moral lessons?
Right. Yeah, it's a really interesting dynamic too, because as you say, the power of the written word seems to be declining so much, and especially removing like print books from the library. In college, I struggled to get my students to purchase a print book for the class, much less, use one in their research paper. It just seems like such a strange rearguard action.
Adam, you point out here that there is a long tradition outside religion of art made with the primary purpose of dictating beliefs and behaviors. This is the stuff that is ordered by authoritarian regimes. How did, say, Soviet filmmakers try to do their work and also keep Joseph Stalin happy?
Yeah, that was a difficult task, certainly, especially because it seemed as though his whims would shift, maybe as much as online trends shift. It's just such a fascinating period to me to think that the leaders of this revolutionary movement thought that art was so powerful that it would like absolutely had to be controlled, and that the ruler of the entire Soviet Union, who had like a lot on his plate, obviously, would call up individual artists on the phone out of the blue to talk to them about whether their art was taking the right direction.
American creative producers don't have to placate a dictator, but their success is shaped at least somewhat by critical reception. When criticism works as intended, Adam, what does it do for art and artists?
I think that the first thing that I want to see in a critical piece, like on a film, for instance, is talking about it on its own terms. What can we see that this film is trying to achieve? Has it chosen the appropriate means? Has it achieved it? And from my perspective, I would rather bracket kind of the broader political implications and connections as a first pass, just to say, is this a well-made film? Does this do what we want films to do? And it just seems as though that is missing, and that's a part of our critical vocabulary that is getting lost.
So it can work to sort of challenge creative producers, to challenge themselves, to make work that excels in many possible dimensions, one of which might be whatever moral message there is, but that's only one element of a successful film.
Right, and I think that an ambitious artist who's trying to make something that will endure is going to try to avoid any straightforward moral message, because that simply is boring, right? And it will become outdated quickly. Works that have greater ambiguity, that have a range of possible interpretations, those are the ones that we still talk about all these many years later, whereas the ones that are just kind of one note, kind of sending the right message, are forgotten. You know, going back to the Stalinist situation, the artists who managed to, you know, get around these very narrow standards, such as like Shostakovich or Eisenstein or other great artists of that period, they created more ambiguous and odd and difficult to interpret works, whereas the people who did the standard kind of ideological writing, things like literally nobody wants to read that stuff anymore.
Yeah. I mean, I'm going to go out on a limb here and assume that most adults don't think they're especially susceptible to being, you know, instantly manipulated by everything they consume as art. Is the problem that we don't trust anybody else to think as critically as we think we're capable of?
I do think there's something like that going on. Often when I'm of criticizing this view, I will say, you know, this is going to be harmful for all those people who get their politics from movies, whereas I personally obviously am not susceptible to that. I mean, everybody thinks that of themselves, right? Nobody thinks, yes, I am a dupe. I'm going to simply follow what the movie tells me.
So how does the trend toward using criticism as a tool for assessing the morality of a work diminish the ability of criticism to do everything it's capable of doing? Like, how does it change the dialogue between artist and critic?
I think it creates an atmosphere of kind of fear or paranoia on everybody's part. I think the critic is like on edge, worried that the artist is trying to slip something by them or is trying to like send a message that they haven't quite picked up on. And the artist is naturally paranoid that somebody is going to take something out of context and run with it, and that their film will be canceled or will be like, you know, hugely controversial for reasons that are arbitrary in the last analysis.
I'm always interested in stories of artists who have a critic that is like feels like a particular nemesis. It doesn't always happen this way, but occasionally at the end of their career, they'll acknowledge that this person was hugely important in driving their work forward. I wonder how much of that is being lost.
Yeah, I do think that the lack of productive dialogue could harm the quality of art in the long term, as it's already harmed the quality of criticism. And that's because political-based criticism is not primarily talking about art, and it's not trying to start a dialogue. It's trying to pass judgment.
What do well-constructed reviews do for viewers and readers and listeners, the consumers of artistic products?
I think that a well-constructed review should, you know, answer basic questions like, is this movie's pacing off? Is it absorbing? Am I going to be sitting there bored looking at my phone? Just like the standards that we have for movies, am I going to enjoy this? There are broadly shared things that people are going to enjoy. And I think that there's a relatively simple task of pointing out whether or not that movie scratches any particular itch. Obviously Barbie is going to scratch a different itch than Oppenheimer, but I should be able to tell which one from the review.
And it is okay to seek out art with the intention of just being entertained. I mean, I'm not saying that it doesn't sometimes carry really important messages, but it feels like we've also lost sight of the fact that sometimes people just need a break from whatever it is they're worried about.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that maybe part of the decline of cinema outside of kind of the big franchises is the sense that movies are homework. Like that this kind of framework where everything is about sending this big political message, like it loses the fact that movies, absorb us, that we just can't tell that the time is passing. Like I can't believe I just spent 3 hours staring at this thing. It didn't even get bored,
Yeah, I'll confess that during Barbenheimer weekend, I had time for one movie, and I chose Barbie, because I felt like it would just be a lighter lift.
Definitely. And I chose to watch Oppenheimer first because I had written this article and I felt increasingly guilty that I had not seen it yet.
I have always been just a little skeptical of people who make art that gets reviewed and claim to never seek out those reviews. But I have to say, considered in the context of your essay, Adam, it's understandable because no matter what message one sets out to leave with an audience, if there is a message at all, it becomes pretty much impossible to get all the moral dimensions right and tell a compelling story. So who wants to read what somebody feels is missing?
Right, especially because it so often feels arbitrary or it feels like an external standard is being applied that you didn't have in mind at all. And I think that we have to take a step back here and talk about where the trend kind of comes from, too, because the types of critics that you're talking about who had this rich dialogue with the filmmakers and things like this, like those types of careers just aren't available anymore. Most reviewers are freelancers. Most papers are interested in clicks and content that kind of has this kind of very narrow moral judgmentalism thing that's gonna like make you mad or something is more clickable than something that's like, oh, let's look at the nuance of this.
That's really interesting. It sort of speaks to the same problem of not having as many tenured professors out there, right? There's a little bit less freedom to say what you really think and explore ideas that may be provocative if you're not sure that you'll get that next freelance gig.
Right. And I also think that this goes hand in hand with the reduced place of like the humanities in college curricula is that we're so busy trying to give them the very most basic skills in all of these fields that we can't even get to those bigger issues that would be more interesting and engaging because we first have to give them the basics and then they never follow up on it.
Do you feel like when you are presenting classic works to students now, do you offer context in a different way than you might have in the past?
Yeah, I think so. There are a lot more sensitivities. There are some texts that are simply not teachable even anymore. Like I used to offer a course on Ovid's Metamorphoses that trace kind of the influence of those stories, those mythical stories on art and music. It was a really fun class. We got to like learn a lot about a lot of different periods of art and music. But many of those stories are unfortunately centered on a god sexually assaulting a human. And students nowadays seem much more sensitive to that, in ways that are appropriate. But it seems like in the current climate that it's just the better part of valor to not even try to introduce that.
Yeah, I've noticed in the past few years, looking at the world through a post-Me Too lens, like a lot of Shakespeare is really offensive to modern sensibilities. I still have the sense that there's something to be gained from interacting with these works, but I can imagine sometime in the not so distant future when those are excised as well.
Yes, I mean, ironically, we're talking about how, liberals or leftists might object to those works, but ironically, the conservatives are way ahead on this, that some of these bans on sexual content have actually hit Shakespeare too, and that teachers are finding that they can't teach an entire Shakespeare play because it talks about sex or something like that.
So, what do we lose if we shield ourselves from any encounters with content that might run in the face, fly in the face of our values?
Yeah, I think that part of being a kind of liberally educated person is realizing that you have not found the final answer, and that reading things that differ or that take, kind of unexpected directions, or that have content that make you uncomfortable, that you still have room to grow and there's room to broaden your mind. Not necessarily by accepting that viewpoint, but by understanding it, maybe even better to combat it in a way.
It does seem, Adam, that it's also, let's assume that a particular artist has a moral message buried within, or not so buried within their novel or their play or their movie or song or whatever it might be. I mean, that artist would be delighted to think that everyone who came across the work was suddenly instantly converted to their way of thinking. We know from like millennia of human experience that that's not how it goes.
Right. I mean, the same goes with teaching, too. Like, there's this great fear that teachers are going to indoctrinate students and just, turn them into liberals or communists or whatever you're worried about. But I have never had a student adopt my viewpoint because it was my viewpoint. There were a couple students who had an unexpected reaction to my class. I taught a class that included some liberation theology in it, and I had one student. Who was from Africa and who belonged to a conservative Pentecostal church declare that she was going to be a liberation theologian when she went home. And I was like, huh, have I done something here that I felt weirdly responsible for whatever the outcome was. But then I also had a student who decided to start experimenting with Episcopalianism. Like, it just doesn't, there's just never this kind of one-to-one correspondence. And I think that an artist who is smart and who thinks seriously about the moral impact of their work would actually be scared to think that everybody is simply reading off what they say and doing it.
I mean, it seems like missionaries who have gone earnestly all over the world could be the first ones to tell you that just exposing people to what they believe doesn't automatically create converts.
Yes, definitely. And, there's this whole body of scholarship on the fact that the people who took that message from the missionaries ran with it in their own direction and created a new version of Christianity that the missionaries didn't always intend for them to do.
You make this point in the piece that I think is really interesting. Trying to please everybody in a kind of moral, political dimension makes for bad politics, and it also makes for bad art. Are there people who are making things today with the sole intention of getting people on board with a particular idea? I mean, do those films and books even rise to the level of being kind of nationally known?
Yeah, I think the Christian music that I was talking about at the beginning, some of those artists have risen to the level of national, fame, but often after leaving behind the kind of narrowly Christian message. Like Katy Perry was actually originally a Christian artist, and so was Sufjan Stevens, but nobody associates them with that anymore. I think the biggest name film that had this kind of straightforward message, it's called God's Not Dead, and it was about an atheist professor who gets shown up by a plucky young Christian student or something like that. And it mainly became famous because people were making fun of it.
Have we effectively reached a moment where we expect art to function as propaganda?
I think that almost the bigger problem might be that by crossing these signals so much, we kind of expect our politics to be a form of entertainment.
Huh. Talk more about
Like, I
that.
think, well, like, I saw recent polling of Republicans, kind of rating the different candidates, and we know that Trump is still ahead no matter what happens, right? And some of the stats where he was really far ahead was which candidate is the more fun? Which candidate is more funny? And I think, I mean, obviously Trump is more entertaining than Ron DeSantis or something like that. But the fact that that's even the standard, it seems as though something has gone wrong here.
We've also entered this era, Adam, in which it's not only critics whose voices directly reach cultural producers. Social media have given everybody potentially a direct line to artists. How are citizen critics influenced by the tone of professional criticism, or does it work the other way around?
I think it is probably mainly the other way around now, that to get your criticism read, you have to reach a social media audience that is expecting these kind of templates of criticism. And so it becomes kind of a self-reinforcing cycle where, in order to get attention, the professional writers are kind of reinforcing the bad habits that they see online.
One vexing reality you point out here is that often the harshest criticism of the moral content of a particular work comes not from people whose ideologies are vastly different from the artist, but from those within their own sort of ideological or political tribe. Will you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think this goes back to what we were talking about earlier, where like the demand seems to just go on and on. It can never be fulfilled. Like there's always this leftover bit of problematic content, or there's always this kind of failure of adequate representation. And it seems as though viewers are naively kind of assuming that certain texts are going to just absolutely fulfill all their expectations, and kind of reacted with this kind of wounded entitlement if it's not.
Are there good ways that we can move ourselves away from this kind of juvenile understanding of how art might affect our beliefs and behaviors?
Yeah, I think that one way to do it, which would probably be helpful for me as well, would be to simply spend less time online and, go find those publications that still do support serious criticism, places like the New Yorker or something like that, or even the Financial Times has surprisingly great film reviews.
And of course, we're allowed to disagree with the critics, right? They're not writing with the understanding that every viewer will take their assessment and sort of change the thinking that way.
Right. Yes, I think that this is what's lost, is that a good critic draws our attention to things that will hopefully help us to enjoy a work better or differently or more, not give us grounds to dismiss it or to cast it aside based on something that has nothing to do with what the artist wanted to do. This is where I think the fundamental disconnect is that art is not primarily trying to get us to do something. It's an experience that we're having in the moment. And whatever after effects it has are secondary at best.
I also wonder about all the great stuff we might be missing out on because it doesn't sort of fit with our political beliefs or understandings of the world.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's a greater danger more recently with these standards, like that we shouldn't read Shakespeare because it has these, kind of misogynistic content. I mean, it does have misogynistic content, but we're all adults here. We're not going to become misogynists from reading it. Shakespeare is one of the greatest authors ever. It just seems as though people are cutting themselves off from potentially some of the most meaningful works and most enjoyable works as well.
Do you think any of this accounts for why, we're in this era of a lot of remakes and a lot of sequels and a lot of, taking something that worked already, and making another version of it. I mean, part of this obviously has to do with the economics of filmmaking in particular, but I also wonder if people are just more afraid to take artistic risks.
Yeah, I think that probably this tendency that I'm talking about is part of a broader tendency towards greater focus on comfort and familiarity. Characters you already know, plots whose basic beats you already can predict, that this is much easier to process for people. But I think it also, we need to talk about the economic incentives too, because typically when a studio buys an intellectual property, it costs a lot of money. And so they're going to try to get as much money out of that investment as they possibly can. And it seems like a safer investment than taking a risk on something new that doesn't have these kind of guaranteed built-in comforting kind of qualities.
Have you followed the story this summer of the movie called Sound of Freedom, which is the story of this former government agent who rescues kids from a sex trafficking ring? It was hugely marketed, especially in conservative media, and it's made like $170 million at the box office. However, it has also become kind of a litmus test. Many conservatives feel obligated to see it. Liberals wrote it off based on the marketing and wouldn't even consider seeing it. As a critic, how would you approach a movie like that that's already divided people politically just based on the marketing?
Yeah, I think that to the extent that I understand that movie, some of the divisiveness comes from the content itself, that it very much is kind of following a QAnon type of plot. And so to that extent, it is kind of designed as propaganda. And to me, that very fact would make me much less open-minded to its artistic quality. But I would think the same, actually, of something that kind of had like, a left-wing message as well, where it was clear that that was very front and center, that they're trying to send this message and illustrate this political point.
Do any of your students have a desire, presumably they do, I'm curious how often you have students who hope to make art themselves in the future and how they start to think through these questions while they're still students?
Yeah, that's a good question. And unfortunately, I don't have a ton of students recently who have been interested in creating their own art. But it does seem like for the students who do, that kind of narrating this kind of very, very personal experience, often with a focus on painful or traumatic experiences, becomes a focus in part because it's not going to trip all of those wires of political controversy. If I'm narrating my experience and only speaking for myself, I'm not going to be able to offend anybody else.
I'm always interested in criticism of nonfiction books in particular, in which someone is brought in to critique the work who is an expert in some, you know, small element of what the author has covered, and they really go after the fact that the work doesn't cover the thing that they care the most about. And I imagine this is even more pronounced when you're looking at the moral content of things.
Yeah, that's interesting. For us academics, whenever we submit a potential publication to an official like journal or academic publisher, they will send it off to one of our peers to review it. And kind of the cliche is that the reviewer is going to say, "Why didn't you cite my work? Why didn't you talk about what my thing is?" This kind of again, wounded narcissism. And I think you can see something similar too. Like, why aren't you talking about my issue? Why aren't you talking about my moral conviction?
Of course, humans are also, you know, very social creatures, and we can't help but care what other people think. Every once in a while on social media, someone will ask a question about what is a movie that you know is great that you just couldn't stand? And people are so sheepish about admitting that they didn't love a film that is recognized to be great.
You're really, I find almost the opposite, that people are kind of proud to say that they they bucked with the consent. No, Citizen Kane sucks. I hated it. Like,
what does it take for artists to keep their choices from being unduly influenced by moralizing criticism?
Yeah, I think that probably the practice of avoiding such material is for the best. I think that sometimes artists probably should simply avoid responding to it or making public comment too, because they just wind up getting themselves into more trouble because they're entering a territory that's full of all of these kind of rhetorical landmines. I think that simply letting the artwork speak for itself is probably the best way to go. Just try to make it as, you know, well-crafted a piece as it as you can make it, and hoping that the people whose opinions are actually informed will see it for what it is.
It's funny that we are not comfortable anymore with a story that is just a story, therefore interesting, right? There has to be like a good guy and a bad guy. There have always been heroes and antagonists, but it's almost like we feel like it's just beneath us to consume work just for the sake of being carried away into a different experience.
Yeah, I think that goes towards the kind of self-centeredness or narcissism that I was talking about, that like a great artwork takes us outside of ourselves. It gives us an experience that we can't have by ourselves. That's why we need the artwork. And the fact that we are so kind of distrustful of that seems to speak to a greater kind of individualization and atomization of society, that we don't trust somebody to take us out of ourselves without having some kind of agenda. We don't trust that somebody just wants us to experience something new and interesting and beautiful.
I think about Mark Twain anticipating this in the 19th century, right, when he published Huckleberry Finn, and, you know, he put this disclaimer at the start of the novel. He wrote, "Persons attempting to find a motive in this narrative will be prosecuted. Persons attempting to find a moral in it will be banished. Persons attempting to find a plot in it will be shot." Of course, it had all of those things, and it's pretty clear that Twain had a message in mind. And of course, his work has become quite controversial since that time. But he clearly knew that it would not hit everybody in a place that felt comfortable.
And that was probably primarily because of the humanity with which he portrayed the enslaved Black character, Jim. I think back when I was in junior high or high school, we had like a summer read that everybody had to do kind of before the fall classes started. And it was Huckleberry Finn. And the main thing that I remember is that it had the N-word in it absolutely constantly.
Mm.
And it seems like that in itself makes it very difficult to teach that as well.
How can we learn to use criticism better so that we use it to help us explore and interpret art rather than just kind of giving us a pass-fail based on moral content?
Yeah, I think this is where, you know, again, reading kind of criticism of the past might be a good way to do this. You know, reading some of the essays that have endured, you know, kind of talking about a particular novel or film or, you know, great critics of the past, to try to reconnect with that more purely aesthetic impulse and get past this kind of jumping to conclusions and setting up artwork to fail. But I just keep coming back to this idea that perhaps the solution is that we should all simply spend less time online.
Can we reward the critics and the artists who recognize that morality is only one of many important dimensions within a lot of works?
Yeah, I think to the extent that we have influence, we could try to direct people's attention to that. You know, even my own article, you know, given that I was mainly being critical of certain writers, like I probably would have done better to say, and here's somebody who's doing it better. I think I got caught up myself in that kind of negative, judgmental attitude, even if it was kind of at this like second degree.
Did you hear from people who were upset with your critical assessment of the state of criticism?
There were some people who were defending a kind of political approach to criticism, by saying that, of course, artworks have political content and it's artificial to expect us not to talk about it. And that's obviously correct, although many artworks don't seem to have any particular political content or political goals. And there's always the risk when you talk about online trends, like I was talking about, that people will say it's not important or it's not representative or you should focus on something more important. And perhaps they were right about that. But it does seem like much of the response that I received was positive, and people were like, "Yes, we realize that this is bad," even if they went on to do the same thing in their next tweet.
Adam Kotsko teaches in the Scheimer Great Book School at North Central College. His recent essay for The Atlantic was titled "Moralism is Ruining Cultural Criticism." Adam, thanks so much for the conversation.
Thank you.
You can find us on Facebook and Instagram and get the podcast wherever you like to get podcasts. To find it, just do a search for KERA Think or find it at our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.